If I ask my boss for a 10% raise and my boss says, no, I think you deserve a 3% raise. It sounds like we're negotiating about money, but mostly I'm negotiating over my self-esteem. I'm negotiating over the fact that I think I provide enough value for the customer, for the company to pay me 10% more. And clearly my boss doesn't value me. And now it's all emotional. These negotiations are very fraught for a lot of people, and it has nothing to do with the actual dollar amount. So you're right. I think the emotions, it's not that just the emotions get in the way. The emotions are very often the star of the show. And unless you know how to negotiate the emotional side of what's going on, you're not really able to manage your own behavior, and you're certainly not able to manage the responses of the other person as you negotiate.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand.Live show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
And welcome back to another episode of the Your Living Brand.Live show. Welcome back, my wonderful audience. It's Ben coming to you live again. And I appreciate you guys coming back to me week after week, month after month, year after year. You know, we're 5.5 years into the show, and I appreciate you guys so much. You email me at ben@yourbrandmarketing.com. You converse with me on LinkedIn and tell me what you like, what you don't like, and what you want to hear. And I listen. I always listen, and I always appreciate, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I always want to find out, what are you guys curious about? Because that's really where the thing is all about. The show is about you. The show is about helping you be better in your world. So this week, I'm bringing Moshe Cohen onto the show. And Moshe is the author of a book called Collywobbles: How to Negotiate When Negotiation Makes You Nervous. I want to talk about getting out of your own way when you are negotiating. So Moshe, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ben. Well, happy to be here.
Well, we always have a good time when you and I talk offline. So I figured, you know what? I've got to get you on the show. You're a professor at Boston University. You've written 2 books. You're telling me you got 3 or 4 or more in the hopper right now. And I want to talk to you about, who are you right now? Who are you? Where did you come from? What brought you to this point? And let's talk about negotiating.
So it's sometimes hard to know where to start when people ask me who I am. What I do professionally is I teach people how to negotiate, and I teach other related subjects such as leadership, influencing skills, stakeholder management, change management, communication skills, and conflict resolution. I'm also a professional mediator, and I mediate disputes of all kinds in all sorts of different settings. And I teach the skills that I teach both at Boston University, where I'm a senior lecturer at business school, but mostly in companies and organizations all over the world. And I've been doing that for quite a long time. The funny thing about my background is that I actually started off in physics. My undergraduate was in physics. And after doing physics for 4 years, I discovered that physics was really hard and I couldn't possibly stay in it. So I went into what seemed easier at the time. I went into electrical engineering, and I was an engineer for a couple of years and decided if I was going to be an engineer, I should have a degree in it. So I actually went up to Canada. I went to McGill and got a master's in electrical engineering, specializing in robotics. And I was a roboticist for the next 11 years and had a great time, worked on some very interesting projects, but over time found myself moving more towards the people side of things, not so much the computers and robot side of things. So I went to business school to go into management. And I loved business school, but then I realized I hate managing things. But the one thing I really loved in business school was my negotiation and organizational behavior classes. So as a result of that, I became a mediator and then started teaching.
That's a fascinating look at your life, to sit there and say, all right, this is a person that must be extremely analytical. If you started off in physics and then went into electrical engineering and robotics, there's a very analytical part of your personality. There has to be. You know, those disciplines demand it. But to go there and then sit there and say, all right, now I'm sitting there going, wait a second, I love the human psyche. This human psyche and psychology and the passions of man and woman bring us to the X factor, which is no two people think alike. No two people see the exact same situation exactly the same way. And therefore, the rules that apply in those analytical viewpoints tend to be thrown aside in a lot of negotiations and a lot of arbitration, because you're not only dealing with fact, but you're also dealing with emotion and perception.
That's absolutely true. And think about it. If you've ever been in a relationship and you've had a disagreement with your relationship partner, and you tried to resolve things based on the fact that analytically speaking, you were right, that never goes well, because there is that human factor and there are emotional ramifications to decisions that can't be explained analytically. And people will sometimes say to you, I don't care if you're right. This is what I want anyway. So
I get that on a regular basis for my clients.
There's got to be more to it than that. And I was a little bit unusual because I was an engineer that had people skills more than some of my colleagues. And frankly, they were stronger at the analytical skills than I was. I was good, but they were better at that part of things. So I think that we're all more multifaceted than we give ourselves credit for. And I think it was just a matter of really focusing on one side of my personality and my mind and less on the other side, which had been the main event for many years.
And I agree with that. Now, I want to go back to that and just sit there and say, all right, let's think about that. Let's think about the fact that human beings are not black and white. We're not black and white as humanity. We look at these 50 shades of gray, and I may see different shades of gray than you do. All the shades of gray are there. The question is, which are the shades of gray that we're willing to accept, and which are the shades of gray that we're not willing to accept? And how do we look at situations in a way where we can sit there and say, wait a second here, I don't perceive things the way that you do. You don't perceive the way, things the way I do, but that doesn't make me 100% right and you 100% wrong.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, the world is a very complicated place. And in order to deal with it, we tend to simplify. And that's why we only can focus a subset of those grays, as you mentioned. And the fact that we perceive and gravitate towards different of those subsets causes us to see things very differently. But very often, once we get there, what we see is self-consistent, and we actually have a hard time even seeing and validating what another person is seeing, let alone coming to a meeting of the minds with them. So I think the problem is even more fundamental. It's not just coming to agreement. It's even understanding that someone else can see things completely differently than we do. I have a younger sister, and if you ask each of us to describe our family growing up, and you put us in separate rooms, we described two different families, even though from my perception, there was just one family. And from her perception, there was just one family, and it was the same family. So I think that's a really fundamental, and I think you've hit on a really fundamental part of human nature.
Well, I agree with that. If you look at my brother and I, we're both grown adults. We're both in our 50s. And if you ask us both about our childhood and growing up in the exact same house with the exact same parents, we will tell two completely different stories. The fact that he's 3 years younger than I have had a completely different context. I was out of the house by the time he was 14 years old. He was living overseas for a year in the middle of, you know, my second last year of high school. So we really didn't have a lot to do with each other growing up from the time we were 12 or 13 years old. And we had different views of our parents, different relationships with our parents, different sets of needs, different sets of friends. We went to different schools. And because of that, we have a very different viewpoint of what's right and what's wrong in the world, whether it's politically, whether it's religiously, whether it's whatever. But we were raised by the exact same set of parents. And I think that we need to be able to be conscious of that, that just because we think this one way doesn't mean that's the same way everybody else thinks.
Yeah, and I think that's an ambitious thing, because I think most of us have a hard time elevating above our own plane to the point where we can recognize that other people are actually different to what we are. Yeah, I think that's very hard for us to do. I mean, it's hard for me to do, and I'm super aware of these things, but in the moment, it's hard for me to do anyway. And I think most of us just don't have the awareness, and we don't have the time or energy to even go outside our own perspective and recognize that it might not be the only way of seeing the world. So yeah, that's one problem. And there's people have a lot of challenges when it comes to trying to come together on things.
So would you say that that is one of the biggest factors when we're negotiating? And it doesn't matter if we're negotiating as children with a sibling or with a parent or at work or with friends. Would it be the fact that we can't move beyond our own biases and our own sense of what's right and wrong that's keeping us from achieving what we truly want to achieve because we can't see the other person's point of view?
It's a factor. I don't know if I would say it's the major factor, but it's certainly a factor. One of the things that helps you negotiate productive outcomes is the ability to actually hear somebody else. If we're negotiating, I need to hear and understand what your perspective is, what your interests are, what you need out of this negotiation. And the problem is, it's really difficult for me to listen and to hear you when I'm too rooted in my own way of thinking. You know, you have to have a bit of an open mind to actually hear the other person without filtering it so much through your own filters that you're not really hearing them anymore. So yeah, it's certainly a factor. It impacts your ability to listen, and your ability to listen is critical to being able to negotiate effectively.
Could valuing person also be a factor? I mean, I talk to people that say, listen, listening is good, understanding is another factor, and they're both extremely important, but you also need to value that person. You need to value that person for who they are. And the question is, do we go as far as actually valuing the person for who they are with their set of values when we're in negotiation or when we're in a conversation, or are we strictly trying to get people to believe what we believe and think how we think?
I think we should always try to value other people. I think that having that as your fundamental mindset is a healthy thing. I also think we need to separate that from negotiation. It's a helpful thing when we negotiate, but it's not necessary. I mean, I can negotiate a deal with a car dealer where the car dealer doesn't really value me and I don't really value the car dealer, but we are able to come to a meeting of the minds over the price and the terms and the type of vehicle, and the deal happened. So it's not a necessary condition, but it's a very helpful condition, especially when the negotiations are more complex rather than involving a simple transaction like a car purchase.
I was thinking about that when you were saying the car transaction, because I've unfortunately been through enough car transactions and house transactions. In a lot of cases, it's commodity driven. If I can't hammer a deal with you, I'll go somewhere else and buy that exact same car somewhere else. If I can't buy this computer from you, I'll go somewhere else and buy this computer. And it tends to be more, I want this, you want that. Either we come to an agreement or I'm walking away. But when it comes to the fact of where you can't walk away, whether it's with the relationships or something at work or protracted conditions within a societal, it's a lot more difficult and the emotions come into play. And I find that negotiation becomes far more about emotional attachment than it becomes about the commodity itself that's either being haggled and either, you know, the price is either being accepted or not being accepted.
So completely agree. And I agree with you in two very separate points you made. Real negotiations tend to be much more complicated than one-time commodity transactions. Even imagine you have a dispute with a neighbor over, let's say, a barking dog. Now, at the end of resolving that dispute, I might still not like my neighbor, and my neighbor might still not like me, and I don't appreciate my neighbor at all, and they don't appreciate me. But can we come to a resolution that allows us to live on good terms with each other? Absolutely. And
or at least not live on bad terms with each other.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, the idea is, can I create a negotiated agreement that gives my neighbor what my neighbor really cares about and gives me what I really care about enough so we can both live harmoniously enough next to each other? That's one point, and I agree with you completely. The other one is that very often what we're negotiating about is very different from what we seem to be negotiating about. So, for example, if I ask my boss for a 10% raise and my boss says, no, I think you deserve a 3% raise, it sounds like we're negotiating about money, but mostly I'm negotiating over my self-esteem. I'm negotiating over the fact that I think I provide enough value for the customer, for the company to pay me 10% more. And clearly my boss doesn't value me. And now it's all emotional. These negotiations are very fraught for a lot of people, and it has nothing to do with the actual dollar amount. So you're right. I think the emotions, it's not that just the emotions get in the way. The emotions are very often the star of the show. And unless you know how to negotiate the emotional side of what's going on, you're not really able to manage your own behavior, and you're certainly not able to manage the responses of the other person as you negotiate.
Hi, everyone. Do you want to be your best customer's vendor of choice? Do you want to cement relationships with them, add real value, and gain insights that your competitors just can't get? Go to podcasthostforhire.com. That's podcasthostforhire.com. And let's work together to make you the value vendor of choice. Is it about figuring out wants versus needs and why?
That's a huge part of it. So when Fisher and Urey were getting to Yes back in 1980.
Right on my shelf, right over here.
Everybody should have it on their shelf. It's a great book. And the main point in the book was to go from positions to interest, to go from what people say they need to what they actually need, to go from the wants to the needs and uncover the fears, motivations, and needs driving people in their negotiations. And if we can center our negotiations around the needs, all of a sudden things get better. So instead of saying to an employer, I want $80,000, you say to the employer, I want to be paid the market rate for the job I'm doing because I don't want to feel like I was hired at a lower rate than my peers or than someone else that would be hired into the position. You express that way, and it's very hard for your employer to say, no, you should be paid less than the market rate. Now it's a much more straightforward discussion around why I want what I want, and it makes a lot more sense. It makes it more reasonable to have these kind of conversations.
And it could also be the fact that you're sitting there going, okay, why does this person need a 10% rate? They've moved from rural Oklahoma to Los Angeles, and their rent is $1,500 a month more. And you're sitting there going, okay, this person's feeling cash strapped and poor and stressed because they took this job in Los Angeles, but they didn't realize the cost of living was significantly more. So it has less to do with the money. It's more about feeling secure in their own position and feeling the fact that are they going to be able to pay their rent and their food and take care of their kids, etc. So we need, when we're negotiating, if I understand you correctly, to be able to sit there and say, okay, why is this person asking for this? What can I give them to make their life easier? Maybe I can't give them the 10%, but maybe I can give them something that's equal to that, that will enable them to be able to be better off in the long run.
So both sides of that are absolutely true. When you express what you need to the other person, express it in terms of your interests. If you were my boss and I said, I need 10% more, you're like, whoa. But if I say to you, to take this job, I moved from a rural area to Los Angeles, and now with my current salary, I can't seem to pay the rent here, and I need an adjustment to my salary to make this livable for me. Then you're more inclined to say, what does that look like? And then I can say the 10%. And now we're having a very different kind of conversation. So first of all, learning to express yourself from your interests rather than your positions. But the other one is to be curious. Whenever anybody says anything to you, there are interests behind that statement. And if you could transform your mindset to saying, okay, this person said they wanted 10% without agreeing or disagreeing with them, I want to find out what's more about what's behind that. And to say, well, it sounds like you're looking for a pretty substantial raise. What's going on? And getting them to talk about those underlying needs, then once you find out their interests, you now have the means to try to look for creative solutions that might meet their interests without costing you the 10%.
So do you think that people are curious innately?
Not enough. I think we naturally tend to be more judgmental and reactive than we are curious. And I think it takes a certain calm presence of mind to be curious. Some people naturally are. I think many times, not enough. And most people aren't. I think most people are much more likely to judge a statement than to be curious about it.
And why do you think people aren't curious? I mean, I've got my own thoughts, ideas on that, but why do you think we've lost our curiosity? Because off air, you and I talked about the fact that kids are curious. As children, we are. We're curious human beings. But as we grow, that curiosity seems to subside. What's your thought process and why that's happening?
So not an expert in children, though I have a bunch. But my sense is that it's hard to feel curious when you don't feel safe. And there's something about the innocence of childhood where, for many children, not all children, you're in a protected environment that allows your curiosity to flourish. And then as we grow up, the world becomes a scary place, and we tend to look at things much more as threats than we do as opportunities. And when we feel threatened, that triggers our fight or flight instinct. And when we get into that fight or flight mode, we're much more likely to judge what's coming at us and think about how do we deal with it rather than feel confident enough to just be curious about it. That's just a theory. I don't know if it's got any validity at all.
I think you're right. I think there's a lot more people out there more afraid of being fired than they are worried about doing what it takes to stand out to be promoted. And I think that that's a terrible place for us to be as a society, where we don't feel that we have the ability to take risks, be curious, and stretch ourselves in order to become who we are meant to be. And a lot of that comes down to company culture. A lot of that comes down to leadership. A lot of that comes down to lack of opportunity of leaders to be able to be great mentors and coaches for their team members and empowerment. But I look at it and go, okay, how do we get out of our own way? I mean, to go back to our original point, this is when we're negotiating. If all of this is reality, if all of this is true, and we still need to negotiate, how do we get out of our own way and enable ourselves to put ourselves in a position where we can negotiate successfully, even though we are scared, even though we are worried about what the ramifications may be?
It's interesting because this gets to the heart of the reason I wrote Collywobbles, because I've been teaching negotiation for over 25 years. And one of the things that I observed is that we keep teaching people skills and strategies, and then they go to use them and they choke. Something happens between the theory and the execution that gets in the way. And the main thing that gets in our way is us. And typically it's something in the emotional realm. We get excited, we get nervous, we get overwhelmed, we get angry. And those emotional responses keep us from actually being able to use the skills and strategies that we've developed. And I kept thinking, you know, it's not very useful to keep teaching people skills and strategies if we don't also teach them how to manage their emotions in real time so they can actually use what they brought to the table. So that was the inception of Collywobbles. And you want to look at it in a number of realms. One is you want to help people manage those immediate emotional reactions that happen in the moment, because life happens in moments. It's like dieting. You could have the perfect diet until 11 o'clock at night when you break down and have that ice cream. So exactly. And you were doing great until that moment. But in that moment, you lost it. Same thing in negotiation. I could be conducting a great negotiation when all of a sudden, the person on the other side of the table folds their arm and says no, or threatens to walk away, or starts to cry. And then I capitulate and give them what they want. Why? Because I didn't manage that moment. So one of the things that we need to do is give people tools to manage those moments, to recognize them really fast, because they happen to spring on you typically, and then to manage them so they don't do things that they regret. The second thing is to raise their overall awareness of what they're bringing into the negotiation, because the more awareness they have of those things, their fears, their narratives, all those things that they bring into it, the more that they'll have the ability to manage, the less impact those things will have on their negotiations. So separating out those two things, I'll actually start with the second one, because you already brought it up. In negotiations, a lot of people negotiate out of fear. And the three major fears that people bring into their negotiations are fear of tangible hurt, something bad will happen, a fear of relationship damage, the person's going to hate me, or emotional pain. This is going to be very painful. So for example, if I'm negotiating with my boss for a raise and I push too hard, I might lose my job. That's tangible hurt. Or maybe I won't lose my job, but my boss will now forever look badly upon me. Now that's relationship damage. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, I want to negotiate for a promotion, but I'm afraid of damaging the relationship with my boss. I got to tell you, if you try to negotiate for promotion and you damage your relationship with your boss, you've already had a problem in that relationship. You're not creating it now. And the fear we have of damaging relationships is actually much, much higher than the likelihood that we're actually going to damage relationships. And yet it drives us in our negotiations, and very often it prevents us from even engaging. And the third part is negotiations involve painful emotions. Very often you ask for something and you get rejected, or you get laughed at, or the other person acts as if you've just done something horrible to them. And we tend to shy from emotional pain. So we are very much driven by the fear of tangible hurt, relationship damage, or emotional pain. And that causes us either to not engage at all, to rush through our negotiations so we minimize the pain, or to make really bad choices and give away things we shouldn't give. Now, fears aren't bad. Fears are normal. You know, cats have fears, squirrels have fears, humans have fears. It's when we let the fears define our behavior, that's when we've gotten into the realm that's not healthy. And the antidote to that begins with self-awareness. And that's true for anything relating to emotional intelligence. It starts with self-awareness. So you need to be aware what you're afraid might happen if you negotiate. And it's helpful not to think, what am I afraid of? Because that makes it sound like I'm not supposed to be afraid. It's, what am I afraid might happen? Because now I'm starting to analyze, what are the consequences that I anticipate might happen here? And a lot of the work I do with people I coach or with my students has to do with stopping them and saying, all right, here's what I'm observing. You need to pick up the phone and call that person to negotiate, but you're procrastinating and not doing it. What are you afraid might happen if you do? And now all of a sudden they're talking about those fears, and just saying them, they become less fearful. So it starts with self-awareness.
And we can't control other people's actions, but we can control our own reactions.
Absolutely.
And the key thing with that is to sit there and say, all right, probably our fears and our trepidations are far worse than anything that could actually ever happen. Here's the worst thing that could happen to you. You get fired. The worst thing that can happen to you in a job is that you could get fired. That chance of that happening is very, very slim. If you have a boss that fires you through a negotiation for whatever reason, as you said earlier, there's probably something bigger happening that should have been managed and should have been dealt with way earlier than this. But the opportunity on the other side for advancement, if you don't ask, you don't get. If you don't present it in a way that's going to be sit there and go, listen, it's not just beneficial for me, it's beneficial for you. That's where we need to be. So how do we help people get beyond the fact that it's all about me and negotiate at a point where they're sitting there going, it's not good just good for me, it's good for us?
Well, that has a lot to do with how you communicate. And again, communicating around interests is really helpful in that aspect, because you want to communicate both about your interests and your boss's interests. And you say to your boss, I came in here with a certain salary, and that's not enough for me to pay the rent. And I could go look for a waiter job at night and try to make some extra money. And I'm concerned that if I do that, I'll be exhausted coming to work, and I won't be able to give as much as I could here. If there's a way to adjust my salary for the cost of living here, then I'll be able to devote my full attention to the job, and I won't have to distract myself by trying to find more money somewhere else. And that's a way of framing things as something that's good for you and good for the other party. But, you know, it takes a lot of presence of mind to do that. You can't have that conversation if simultaneously your mind is screaming, oh my God, I'm going to get fired for asking for this. That's where you have to manage those emotions. Now, in addition to thinking about the likelihood, I think it's also really helpful to sit with your worst case. All right, I asked my boss for a raise and my boss said, get out, never come back. Now what? And when you start thinking about that, very often it's bad, but not as bad as you thought it was. You have alternatives. You could move in with a relative. You could get another job. You could do a side hustle that will get you by. You could borrow money from. And there are things that you can do to manage that that make it not wonderful, but also not the end of the world. And once you realize you could actually survive your worst case, then you're not afraid of it in the same way. Now, whatever fears we have in our negotiations tend to get amplified by certain factors that cause us stress. Probably the biggest one is conflict. We don't like conflict. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, I hate conflict, I don't like conflict, I avoid conflict. And when I ask them, what's so bad about conflict? Very often, it's a fear of tangible hurt, relationship damage, or emotional pain, because they associate conflict with those things. If we get into conflict, the person's going to yell at me. That's emotional pain. Or the person might retaliate against me. That's tangible hurt, et cetera. Another huge factor that amplifies our fears is uncertainty. And do you ever wonder why almost every kid in the world is afraid of the dark?
Because they don't know what's around the corner. They don't know what's coming out of it.
And what we can't see, we can imagine. And we can imagine some pretty scary things. Notice kids are always imagining monsters under the bed, not puppies. Right? So
definitely never the cute puppy.
No. So the problem is that negotiations, by their nature, are uncertain. In fact, it's one of the things I like about the process, right? You never know how it's going to turn out. I think of that as opportunity. But for a lot of people, it's very anxiety provoking. And you never know what kind of surprises the other person's going to throw at you, or what kind of tricks or strategies they have up their sleeve. There's a lot of uncertainty, and that creates a lot of anxiety for people. And the third one is power perception. When you perceive yourself to be in a lower power position to the other party, then you feel like they can inflict tangible hurt, relationship damage, or emotional pain on you. Now, a lot of times our fears and how we approach these stress factors, and again, we need to be aware of them, are really driven by our narratives, by what we tell ourselves. And we're telling ourselves stuff constantly. about ourselves, about the other party, and about the situation. If I run a small company and I'll negotiate frequently with very large companies. And if I walk into one of those negotiations thinking I'm just a little guy, they're going to dictate terms to me and I won't have a whole lot of choices. Well, I've just put myself completely on the back foot in that negotiation. And I did it to myself through the story I told myself. I don't know how they're thinking. I don't know what they want. But I've created that situation because of my narrative. Similarly, if I'm negotiating with my neighbor and I think, oh, my neighbor is a total jerk. There's no way I can possibly come to an agreement with him. Well, again, I've made that self-fulfilling. So we tell ourselves stories all the time, or even going into, I remember we bought a house in a seller's market. And I'm just one of those incorrigible optimists. I'm like, you know what? Even in a seller's market, there's opportunity. So we kept looking. We looked for a year until we found one, but we did find one. We found happy, but got a great deal on it. But if I say, well, it's a seller's market, I might as well not even try. That's it. I've psyched myself out of the game. And the thing is that these narratives are entirely in our own minds. And therefore, they should be within our power to manage. We can become the authors rather than the victims of our narratives. And in order to do that, we first have to become aware of our narratives. And when I'm coaching someone in negotiations, very often I'll ask them, what are you telling yourself right now?
Well, what was it? I think it was Ford that said, whether you can or you can't, I forget what the line is, but you're right. Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're correct.
I don't remember who said that, but I remember the saying. Absolutely.
I'll have to look it up. I think it was Henry Ford that said that. We need to start bringing this in for landing, but I want to give you the point. If there's one thing you want to give people, one piece of advice when they're negotiating to be able to help them be more effective, what would it be?
Can I give three really quick ones?
You can.
All right. The first one is prepare. People come into their negotiations completely unprepared. And without preparation, you tend to get your feet knocked out of you in negotiations. The second one is slow down. Manage your emotions. Notice when your emotions have been triggered. Your body will give you some clues. Your heart rate will go up and that kind of thing. And then just pause, ask for a break, ask questions, listen, breathe. Slow things down so you can respond rather than react. And the third one is, you have two ears and one mouth, and you should use them in proportion. Spend a lot more time listening than talking when you're negotiating. And if you don't do those three things, you're going to be a much better negotiator.
That's awesome advice. So Moshe, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
So you can always email me at moshe@negotiatingtable.com. And I'm on LinkedIn every day. So just look for Moshe Cohen Negotiations and you'll find me.
Perfect. And here's the last question. And I ask this to everybody as they walk out the door. When you leave a meeting and you get in your car and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
I want them to think about me that they felt heard and valued and validated.
Well, I certainly heard you. I certainly thought that this was extremely valuable. Lots of little tidbits. People need to replay this and think about the little things that you said that will help them negotiate better. So Moshe, thanks for coming on the show.
It's been delightful and absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
This has been the YourLivingBrand.live show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at YourLivingBrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?